1:33 p.m. It's Wednesday, March 10, 1021, or 2021, sorry, too many 10s and 20s. Before we begin, I want to thank Sophia Tenney, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Tom Raymond from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Drummond, my vice chair, Representative Snyder, and myself, Representative Clayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 105, Detention of Minors, sponsored by the House Rules Committee by request of the governor. This is the second hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. Online for questions related to the bill are Tracy Dompling, Director, Division of Juvenile Justice, Matt Davidson, Social Services Program Officer, Division of Juvenile Justice, Nancy Mead, General Counsel, Alaska Court System, and Kelly Good, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Corrections. I'd like to open invited testimony on House Bill 105. And I would first recognize that Representative Eastman has joined us. And I would like to ask Samantha Shiro, the public defender, to offer her perspective on House Bill 105. And Ms. Shiro, if you are on the phone, please make sure you're not on a speakerphone, as the sound quality is not as clear and it is often difficult to hear what you are saying. Please identify yourself for the record, and then you may proceed with your remarks.
Yes, thank you. This is Samantha Shiro, public defender for the Alaska Public Defender Agency. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, loud and clear.
Okay. So thank you to the committee today for the opportunity to testify on HB 105 in support of the bill, particularly children not being held in adult facilities. Keeping children subject to the auto waiver or discretionary waiver in DJJ facilities until they reach the age of 18 should result in better conditions for the impacted children, as long as DJJ has the necessary resources for programming and to care for them. It should eliminate them being held in segregation while incarcerated, and it should ensure their continued access to necessary educational services and programming in DJJ facilities focused on rehabilitation, and which will better enable them to develop the necessary skill sets to reduce recidivism and to foster their continued cognitive development. This is critical given the fundamental differences between juvenile and adult minds, and that the brain is not fully formed until one's mid-20s. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
So I would note that Representative Vance and Representative Kirka also joined us while you were testifying. Questions for Ms. Shiro? Hearing and seeing none, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today. I'm going to close invited testimony. At this time, we will take up amendments to House Bill 105. I'd like to put on the record that Legislative Legal has permission to make any technical and conforming changes to the bill. Our office received two amendments to House Bill 105. The amendment process will be treated like floor amendments. The maker of the amendment moves the amendment and speaks to it with a three-minute time limit. Then we'll take questions, and questions will be limited to 1 minute per question. Then we will proceed to discussion with each member limited to 3 minutes. Finally, the maker of the amendment will have 1 minute to wrap up. When we come to an amendment, the mover can either move the amendment or it will be withdrawn. We will not roll amendments to the back. Today we'll begin with amendment number one, and as I am the sponsor of these amendments, I'll hand the gavel over to my vice chair, Representative Snyder, for the remainder of the amendment process. And I would move amendment number one.
Check. Representative Clayman, can you explain what amendment number one does?
I would actually like to ask the Director of Juvenile Justice to provide details on amendment number one, because that would be Tracy Dompling, because both of these amendments were submitted, or the division asked me to submit these amendments in coordination with their discussions with the court system. So, Ms. Dompling, if you could explain amendment number one.
For the record, Tracy Dompling, Director, Division of Juvenile Justice. Mr. Chair, I would ask, if possible, for Mr. Davidson to go ahead and explain these amendments.
Yes, that is fine. Go ahead, please.
Committee, Madam Chair, my name is Matt Davidson. I'm a Social Services Program Officer with the Division of Juvenile Justice. Amendment number one is corrects a drafting error in HB 105. In section two of the bill, we remove an existing reference in state statute to the holding of non-delinquent minors on page 4, line 30. That's the reference to the two 4712 sections there, 4712.120 and 4712.250. This amendment removes another reference to 4712.250 in section 2 and adds a reference to the process delineated in section 3, the new subsection K. So the existing statute mistakenly contains a reference to how delinquent minors would be held in a process to hold non-delinquent minors. It's a little circular, and we recognized this during drafting of the bill, and so this correction just carries on that correction to remove the reference to delinquency statute in this secure holds for non-delinquent minors.
Any questions?
I apologize for the circular nature of that explanation.
Thank you. Do we have any questions regarding the amendment? Yes, Chair Drummond, or Representative Drummond.
Thank you. I'm trying to find where K of this section is that is plugging in here. Is it right below it on page 5?
Through the chair, it is section 3 is the new subsection K that describes the process under which a court has to go in, consider, and the process for the process of holding non-delinquents temporarily in juvenile justice facilities.
Okay, hold on a minute. I'm seeing it. I'm just trying to figure out when it says K of this section, the word section refers to what? Section 3 on page 12, or there are K's everywhere in this document. That's what I'm curious about.
Representative Drummond, if you look at section 2, it's AS 47.10.141, subsection C. So when they say later on page 5 under subsection K of this section, they're referencing 47.10.141.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And then if you go to section 3, you'll see it's 47.10.141, and there's the subsection K right below.
Okay. Thank you. I'm good with that.
Okay. Any discussion on the amendment? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Well, just another question. I was wondering, what is the practical effect if this amendment fails?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the practical effect is not great, but it is an opportunity to clean up this particular statute and could lead to confusion. Again, delinquents are not held under this process. We have our delinquency statute contains all the process we need for holding delinquent minors in secure facilities. And so I think it could lead to confusion, especially since we have an opportunity to clean it up.
Thank you.
One minute wrap up, Mr. Clayman.
Nope. No comments. No comments.
Is the objection maintained, Representative Drummond?
I remove my objection.
Thank you, Clerk. If you'll call roll.
Brief at ease. Objection. I move amendment number 2.
Object. Good discussion, of course.
Representative Clayman, can you explain what amendment number 2 does?
I'd ask again for Mr. Davidson, and Champlain, you're off the hook for Mr. Davidson, if you could explain amendment number 2.
Happy to. Again, through the record, my name is Matt Davidson. I'm with the Division of Juvenile Justice. Amendment number 2 has some substantive clarifications that were identified in the review process, and we can credit actually Nancy Mead from the court system with a couple of these catches. I think I'd recommend breaking up amendment number two into the three sections. The first change is on page 7, line 22. This clarifies that when the bill says that at the age 18, these minors will be transferred to Department of Corrections custody, this clarifies that we're only talking about the minors that are part of this section. These are the auto waiver minors and discretionary waiver minors, not minors, delinquent minors. And so that's what the amendment does. The first part of that amendment is clarifies that minors who are in DDOJ facilities as part of this new program, but they're considered adults as part of the adult court system, will be transferred to DOC custody at age 18. It does not apply to delinquent minors. In some cases, most DJJ jurisdiction ends at age 18. A court can extend that jurisdiction to age 19, extend it to age 19 with another court finding. And in some very rare cases, if the minor consents to it, a minor can stay in DJJ jurisdiction until age 20. This would not apply to minors who are subject to the auto waiver or discretionary waiver. They would be transferred to DOC facilities at age 18.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, Representative Drummond.
Thank you. If you delete the words, a minor shall be transferred on line 22, and insert that sentence that ends in 47.12.100, the sentence then continues to a facility operated by the Department of Corrections when the minor turns 18 years of age. Did you mean to leave that phrase there or delete the entire sentence? Because that right now it's not making any sense if you do that.
I can answer that question, Mr. Davidson. The initial draft of the amendment used the passive voice in Ledge Legal. It reminded us that we needed to use the active voice, and so in the paragraph C, they're saying that that isn't paragraph C. This is line 7, page 22. Line 22.
Mr. Chairman, I think how the new sentence would read is, the department shall transfer a minor subject to the provisions of 4712030A or 4712100 to a facility operated by the Department of Corrections when the minor turns age 18. That's my read. If you remove the first clause, a minor shall be transferred, and put in the active voice, thank you for that, Ledge drafting, it reads as a complete sentence by my read.
I see. It's confusing me because it's a minor, comma, subject to the provisions of blah, 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 comma, to a facility is how I think it should read. But what do I know? I've just edited stuff for 30 years.
Any additional discussion on the amendment? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I guess just again, for the record, were this amendment not to pass, what is the worst thing that will happen?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I think this amendment is necessary for the bill to move forward. We heard from several parties that it was confusing, including the Department of Corrections, who initially wondered how many minors we would be transferring at age 18 if this bill passed. And the intent is only minors that we are holding on behalf of DOC, not minors that we are holding under delinquency statute who may be 18 or 19 years old in some cases.
And another feature that's important is that the third portion, which is changing the court shall hold to the department shall request, is a change that recognizes that generally the court doesn't take these things up on its own, but they come up when somebody makes a motion. So it puts the responsibility on the department to make the motion for the court to review the status rather than the court doing it scheduling the hearing on its own.
Thank it pleases the chair, I'll continue with the other two portions of this, of amendment number two.
We have one more question, real quick, Representative Eastman.
So do I understand then that currently the drafting under version A allows the court to intervene and gives that judge discretion, and we are now removing that discretion with this amendment? Did I get that right, or am I misreading that?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, no. The first part, the line 7, page 7, line 22, just clarifies that when we're talking about transferring custody to the Department of Corrections, or they were only talking about the waived youth, not delinquent youth.
I'm down in section 2 now, but go ahead and explain that part before we get there, I guess. And
Madam Chair, I think I fouled that up by going down further. I didn't realize Mr. Davidson was only on the first of the three portions of amendment number 2.
Mr. Davidson, would you like to continue to the second part?
Yes, absolutely. So the second part, page 7, lines 27 to 30, clarifies the circumstances that the department would request the court consider variance from this new requirement that these auto-waived minors be held in DJJ facilities. So it's kind of a two-part. It clarifies that it currently reads that if there's no juvenile facility available, which is unclear because we have juvenile facilities all in six communities around the state, but if a trial is being held in Dillingham, for example, or Kotzebue, we want to have the option, and the court, we want to have the court to have the option to just choose to have that waived minor held in the community where the trial is being held. And so that, we wanted to be very specific about that circumstance. The second circumstance is when a minor is inappropriate for a juvenile facility for whatever reason, and the court has to take into consideration the different circumstances of that minor, the age and their behaviors as part of their court finding. And so the part two just clarifies the conditions that we think that the department would seek a waiver from the new rules, and that the department is responsible for making that request. It's not the court that's responsible for tracking that information.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. All right, so back to the previous question then. Is the legal effect of the change from a court may order to now saying the department may request that a court order, is that obviously it's allowing the department to make that request, but is it at the same time denying now the court's ability to do that absence that departmental request, so that if the department doesn't make a request or the department is slow in getting to that, that the court does not have that discretion? Is that the legal effect?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I appreciate the question, I believe Director Dobbin and I, we spoke with you about this kind of scenario. We don't believe that the courts would be intervening in this way, or is that the intent of intervening to decide where a minor should be held? I think Ms. Mead might testify if she was asked that they would prefer that the department make the request and then the courts are willing to make a judgment, but they are not in the business of deciding without request where a minor should be held. As we've said in the previous hearing, we believe that the majority of these cases, the division will be the ones holding minors subject to the waiver, the automatic waiver and the discretionary waiver. And it's not something that we would be, these variances would not be something we would be seeking on a regular basis. We are equipped to handle the majority of these cases, and we think it'd be very rare when we would seek a variance.
Thank you very much.
Any additional discussion? Representative Eastman.
Can you just for clarity on the record, can you explain to us what's the third part of the amendment and what's the significance of that? And if that were to go away, what practical consequences are we talking about?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, are you asking me to move on to page 8, line 12?
Yes.
Page 8, line 12. Again, this is similar to the one aspect of the previous portion of the amendment that emphasizes it's the department's responsibility to request a continuance of that judgment, that a decision by the court that a minor can be held in an adult facility. Again, this is something that the court system requested of us in terms of an amendment to clarify that the court system is not going to be tracking where minors in DOC custody are being held. But if we want to have a variance under this process, we would request it of the court. And so it's an extension of the previous section where the department will request of the court to make a continuation of this finding.
Thank you very much.
Representative Clayman, would you like to do a 1 minute wrap up?
Nope. Thank you, though.
Okay. Is the objection maintained?
I remove my objection.
The amendment is approved without objection. I'll now pass the gavel back to the chair.
Just comment on process. I think once the objection is withdrawn, let's give an opportunity for someone else to make an objection. I wasn't planning it to, but just give that pause so that it could happen if it was going to.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. I appreciate your patience with a new vice chair and a new member of the legislature who's learning faster than I ever did.
Fantastic.
All right. That brings House Bill 105 back before the committee, and that brings us to final comments. As is the norm, I give members one opportunity to make final comments, limited to 3 minutes per member. Any final comments from members of the committee? Hearing and seeing none, Madam Vice Chair, may I have a motion?
I move version 32-GH1576/A of HB 105 as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Hearing and seeing no objection, House Bill 105 moves from committee. If you will take the time to sign the paperwork as it works its way around, we will move on to the second item on our agenda, which is House Bill 3, Definition of Disaster Cybersecurity, sponsored by Representative Johnson. She was here a minute ago, I think. What's that? Briefities. Second order of business today is House Bill 3, Definition of Disaster Cybersecurity, sponsored by Representative Johnson. This is the first hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is Eric Cordero, and he may soon be joined by Representative Johnson. Please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and then you may begin your remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Eric Cordero, and I'm here to present House Bill 3. An act related to the definition of a disaster. Our statutes are vague about whether a cyber attack or a cyber threat could elicit an emergency declaration. This bill adds cybersecurity to the definition of a disaster to update our laws, give clarity, and if necessary, use resources and act if there's a widespread and imminent threat. There is an alarming rate of cyber threats throughout the world and our nation. Not long ago, the Matsu Bureau was shut down after a cyber attack. It created severe disruptions in the day-to-day service and operation of the local government. The city of Valdez was the target of a ransomware attack, and they had to spend a lot of funds in their very limited resources to be able to access their information again. The states of Louisiana, Florida, and Colorado declared an emergency after a cyber attack disrupted most of their government operations not too long ago. And Representative Johnson is here.
Welcome, Representative Johnson. We know you're in the thick of things in the Finance Committee, and we went ahead and got started, but you can pick up where you're ready.
Thank you very much. And for the record, my name is Delana Johnson, District 11. In summary, since I'm certain that my staff has done a phenomenal job so far, appreciate that, and appreciate you letting me sneak in here. In summary, cybersecurity needs to be added to the list of reasons for an emergency declaration. A disaster declaration would provide for the disaster relief funds to apply for federal funds and resources that might not otherwise be readily available. And for disaster preparedness planning and to provide for intervention when the security of Alaskan residents have been compromised. My staffer, Eric Cordero, will come back and go over the language of the bill and the changes and the CS, and we have invited testimony from experts that will be available to answer the technical questions. Our invited testimony is Eric Wyatt, the IT director of the Matsu Borough, Mark Brunig, Chief Information Security Officer, the Alaska State Security Office Department of Administration, and Peter House, cybersecurity expert with Deep Tree Incorporated.
For the record again, Eric Cordero. Thank you for the opportunity again to be here today. As Representative Johnson mentioned, the bill adds cybersecurity attacks and threats to the definition of a disaster. Specifically, the bill adds a subsection F to AS 262900, which are the general provisions of the Alaska Disaster Act. Before I mention the changes on the CS before you, I just want to read what's currently on the CS before you. Section F on page 2, cybersecurity attack that affects critical infrastructure in the state, an information system owned or operated by the state, or a political subdivision of the state, information that is stored on, processed by, or transmitted on an information system owned or operated by the state, or a political subdivision of the state, and I'm sorry, it's kind of repetitive, or a credible threat of an imminent cybersecurity attack or cybersecurity vulnerability that the Commissioner of Administration or Commissioner's designee certifies to the governor has a high probability of occurring in the near future, the certification must be based on specific information that critical infrastructure in the state and information system owned or operated by the state or a political subdivision of the state, or information that is stored on, processed by, or transmitted on an information system owned or operated by the state or a political subdivision of the state may be affected. So that's a lot of words. The changes on the CS basically before you added the word political subdivision to page 2, lines 19, 21, 27, and 29. And the reason why that was done was for clarity, to make sure that boroughs and local governments were not left out, because it could be open to interpretation. So as mentioned before, this is really something that is necessary. We live in a very different world nowadays in which we hear in the news about foreign governments trying to hack our computer systems. It's not just an office building. We're talking about the electric grid. We're talking about hospitals, airports, sources of energy or services that provide critical infrastructure. During the last committee meeting, there were a lot of questions about what critical infrastructure means. It's right now open to interpretation, but right now the duty to make that definition and those priorities is rests in the hands of the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs. And unfortunately, we cannot get somebody from that department to be here today, but we do have other experts that will be able to answer your questions. So at this juncture, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if you have any questions from us or from our experts.
Kind of the will of the committee, we can ask the bill sponsor and Mr. Cordero questions, or we can hear from the invited testimony. You have the four individuals that Representative Johnson identified, we might want to listen to them first, but I'll leave it up to the committee. Questions? Go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. Now, you used the word cybersecurity a number of times in this bill. What is the definition of cybersecurity? I don't think that's defined here. Is that defined somewhere else in statute, or what would we be using to reference the meaning of that?
So cybersecurity and cyber threats would be more of a technical definition by the people that are professionals in here. Usually they're defined as events that result in data exposure or data loss, an unauthorized alteration or impact to a service. And so I would appreciate it if maybe Mark with the Department of Administration could answer this, but there is no exact definition in statute. Cybersecurity, just like technology, keeps changing on a day-to-day basis. So if we have a definition right now, in 3 weeks from now, it could not necessarily mean what we want it to mean. So,
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the intent of this bill, and I think you answered the question of what a political subdivision is, a political subdivision of the state being a borough or a municipality. How are school districts or the University of Alaska related? Because those are massive. There are massive databases in both of those institutions. And are they considered a political subdivision of the state?
So I'm speaking from experience, not from immediate research. But my understanding of the political subdivision, we can confirm this, but a political subdivision, so if you're talking about a school district, that would fall under a borough. That's actually why the boroughs were created originally in 1964 in Alaska, was to oversee and to be able to dispense money to school districts. So the political subdivision would, in that particular instance, would be a borough, or I guess in the state's, and we wouldn't have to have this, well, I guess we would. I was thinking of this, the unorganized borough would be under the state. Unorganized borough schools would be under, you know, the state's purview, and the political subdivision over other school districts would be the borough that was in question. But the University of Alaska does not fall under, is not identified as a political subdivision of the state. It's not an incorporated borough or municipality or city. And I believe that would fall under the state of Alaska, equipment and so on. I can clarify, I can find that out specifically in more detail if you would like.
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Drummond.
I can tell you that the computer systems of the Anchorage School District are totally separate from the from those of the municipality of Anchorage, and there have been some incredible arguments over the last 20 years or so about whether they should be combined. So I'm not so sure that that would apply to a school district that is ultimately governed by that borough or a municipality, which used to be a borough and a city. And I think you're covering the REAAs in the unorganized borough, but I would like some clarity on that, on how all of the, because the state gives the school districts roughly $1.2 billion to spend, and if that gets breached in a cybersecurity attack, there's a lot of services at risk. So I'd like some clarity on those major, what I consider political subdivisions of the state, all the school districts.
Representative Drummond is a longtime member of this committee. You know mm-hmm. about the 1 minute rule, and you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll just ask for another follow up. That's all. I'll get you.
Go ahead. One more chance at a follow up, but I hadn't heard a question yet, so.
I would like clarity on what is included in in the list of political subdivisions. And if it doesn't cover school districts and the university, I'd like to find a way to cover them.
That was a question in under a minute. Excellent. Any other questions from the bill spot? Representative Kirka.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Representative Johnson or Mr. Cordero. I'm a little bit, I guess, cautious about increasing emergency powers. I think they can, I'm concerned they can be abused if we're not careful. And I guess I'd like to hear maybe from more from your experts, but why would a security breach, I guess, go to the level of emergency, or why would a security breach need an emergency declaration to handle the security breach or take care of the security breach? If they could give more of an explanation of how that would help the state or help a political subdivision, resolve the threat or eliminate the threat or resolve the damage of a security breach, and how that would be different with an emergency declaration versus how we operate now.
Representative Johnson.
Okay, and if I might, I want to take just a quick answer to that, and then I, with the chair's permission, allow for my staff and whoever he would think might be the best invited testimony.
Representative, why don't you take the quick stab? It sounds like this is the kind of information, because we've heard this bill in state affairs, it sounds like information we'll hear from your invited testimony. So why don't you take a quick stab at it, then we'll turn to invited testimony.
All right, very good. So this an example would be, and I certainly don't want to say that this is happening, but an example might be something that would be widespread would be during the winter, if you had the power grid compromised, and those are very much something that is connected through with computer switching and so on, and that certainly would be large, widespread, and certainly life-threatening. And that would be an opportunity, or not an opportunity, it would be an occasion where you would potentially need additional funds and additional help to sort that out from maybe even federal or, you know, other experts.
So with that, I think we'll turn to the invited testimony, because I think that'll answer, well, I don't know for sure, but I'm optimistic we'll answer some of the questions and keep us moving. So first, an invited testimony, there's Eric Wyatt, IT Director for the MATSU Bureau. Mr. Wyatt, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yeah, loud and clear, and it sounds like you're not on a speakerphone, so please proceed. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good, thank you. Again, my name is Eric Wyatt. I'm the IT Director at the Matanuska Susitna Borough. And we were the target of a cyber attack in 2018, and I would like to talk a little bit about what that meant to us and how we recovered and how something like this might help us. So the first portion of that is what happened, and we were the subject of an attack, and there's not a single attacker that attacked us. It was actually four different organizations, and as the FBI did their investigation and analyzed who attacked us, they were nation states and organized crime, and we had four of the worst groups and four of the worst viruses as all as part of our network. How they do that is one gets in, then they sell it to other organizations. They get in, they steal data, they disrupt systems, and then then one of the groups may demand ransom, which is what happened in our case. What that did to us as an organization when that happened was it brought down all of our information systems across our entire organization, completely cutting us off from all internet services, from all of the data that we use day to day. Obviously, most of our organizations use our information systems on a continuous basis to conduct all kinds of business. So when we look at the effect for our operations within the borough, most notably would be emergency services. So our fire and EMS systems were affected. And then, of course, we can move on to other things like our operations and maintenance, which are taking care of roads, our solid waste, our finances, our legal, every aspect of the borough was taken down. So what happened in our particular case is when all that was shut off, all people that use our information system, which is telephones, computers, iPads, et cetera, were dead in the water for for a period of time. Again, in the with the magnitude of our attack, everything was shut down, so we were actually down for quite some time. We did start to bring back services slowly, the getting back to about 95% capacity took us about 60 days. What we had to do to recover at the time without an emergency declaration is we do have some emergency funds that we were able to bring to bear. What I needed most to recover the systems at the time were additional manpower. So using some of those emergency funds, we were able to hire some additional resources to come in and help us. In fact, one of the other speakers today, Mr. Peterhouse, was one of those people. We also had a number of other organizations come and volunteer their time to help us to recover. Mr. Mark Brunig is again one of those people that helped to come and help us recover at the time. And so our needs at the time were resources not only monetarily but manpower, and skilled manpower is what was necessary to come in and recover and bring our systems back up and get our operations back online. So the ability to declare a disaster and additionally form a team of experts, maybe as volunteers or paid, to come into an organization like this to help recovery is absolutely critical. Those were the effects on our organization. Our emergency funding ran up close to $2.5 million when we cut off the emergency funds. We did spend more than that on continued recovery, but just the initial recovery was $2.5 million. And as you have heard testimony here, and you know, not only were we hit, but that very same week the city of Valdez was hit with most of the same groups, same viruses, same tactics. You've heard testimony of other states, other cities. You hear it all the time. We've had other attacks here in the state of Alaska as well. So the ability to come to the aid of the organization and plus up the manpower and plus up the resources to recover from this, I think is absolutely vital. And would love to participate as part of that for any other organizations that have these types of attacks as well. One of the things that Representative Johnson just also mentioned was about the critical infrastructure. Obviously, with our electric grid, our telecommunications, our gas lines, all of them also run on these kinds of systems. So the effects of those kinds of organizations from a cyber attack are also greatly damaging, you know, certainly if it's power outages or gas line outages. So I think with that, I would love to answer any questions if you've got.
So Mr. Wyatt, we'll get through all four folks with invited testimony, because then that way you can target the question, because I do think they're offering different pieces of information. I think it's good to have it all in front of us before we begin questions. Next with invited testimony is Mark Brunig, Chief Information Officer for the State of Alaska Department of Administration. Mr. Brunig, please identify yourself for the record, and you can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and House Judiciary Committee members. This is Mark Brunig, Chief Information Security Officer for the State of Alaska and the Department of Administration. So, Mr. Wyatt did comment on the Matsu Borough. I'll take a slightly different tack to add maybe a little bit a different flavor. So the National Guard actually has a federal mandate to create in the states a cyber capability. But currently in Alaska, without this language being added, while they're standing up in that team to accomplish that, they don't have the legal standing to do it. They can't exercise that. And so behind the scenes, they are planning, they are training, but without the language that would enable them to respond to a cyber emergency, a cyber disaster, they would not be able to deploy. So there are resources then that the state would not be able to avail itself of without that language. Any other questions?
Not at this point. We're going to keep going through the other invited testimony, but I just was waiting to make sure you were finished with your comments. Next is Niels Andreasen from the Alaska Municipal League. Mr. Andreasen, if you could identify yourself for the record, and you can proceed.
Thank you, Chair and members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Niels Andreasen, the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League, and really just wanted to call in support of this bill and really appreciate the sponsor moving this forward. We know how important cybersecurity is to Alaska's local governments, to our school districts, to state agencies and others, and with so much shifting online over these last 12 months and really much longer, the risks for destabilization of government agencies at the local, state, and every level is really just so considerable that including this in the definition of a state disaster is, we think, imperative. And we really appreciate, again, the sponsor for bringing HB3 forward and for your consideration and hope to see this move quickly through this committee.
Thank you. And last with invited testimony is Peter House, a cybersecurity expert with DeepTree Incorporated from Wasilla. Mr. House, if you could identify yourself for the record, you can proceed with your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Peter House. I'm the CEO of DeepTree Incorporated. We're an IT firm that specializes in cybersecurity, and like Mark did, I'm going to maybe briefly touch on the Mat-Su Borough incident, but Mr. Wyatt did a fantastic job. There's not a whole lot to cover there. So I'd like to maybe expand back a little bit to talk about the zeitgeist and what's happening. I'm sure that you saw in the news there was the SolarWinds attack that had a lot of significant consequences for the federal government, also for a lot of Fortune 500 companies and even organizations here in the state of Alaska. And then last week, it climaxed really last week, but it was happening for about a month. The Hafnium attack on Exchange or email servers hit about 30,000 American organizations, and I believe about double that worldwide, and that has been attributed largely to the Chinese. Attribution is a dangerous game, but if one looks around and sees who's not getting hit, then we kind of have a sense of who is possibly interested in reaping the results of that attack. So we've got a couple of high-visibility attacks that are showing a higher level of aggression, both from criminal organizations and from nation-state adversaries. But, you know, that's news, and sometimes it's better to get a little bit more quantitative about it. In the fourth quarter of 2020, cyber insurance moved from a soft market to a hard market. And that means, that the portfolio for the insurance company is under pressure. And, usually one starts to see rate increases and all that. The attribution by, insurance companies for this change is the number of cyber attacks and the total size of the claim are both increasing substantially. And over the next few years, there's expected to be about a 20 to 40% rate increase across different cyber insurance carriers countrywide. So in general, what we're seeing is a higher level of aggression. We're seeing more tools. There's a famous example from Operation Yankee Buckshot, where using off-the-shelf, publicly downloadable tools, the Department of Defense attacked itself just to test its defenses and was able to get onto the classified network. So there's a lot of challenge in, working with these complex systems. There's an opportunity that sometimes attackers can make it past the border. They can make it in, and they can reap a significant amount of damage. What a declaration of emergency would be able to do to address Representative Kirka's question directly is let's explore a particular scenario where assets are required to hold evidence for law enforcement or insurance. So that's data or logs that need to be tendered over to the organization. They got to live on hard drives somewhere. Those hard drives usually start, those systems start about $20,000 and march upward from there. So it's a little bit more than going down and grabbing a couple of hard drives at Walmart. If those systems are set aside for evidence retention, they cannot be used for the restoration of services. They cannot be used to clean or sanitize the systems that are required. And so what ends up having is a temporary need for maybe double or triple the amount of storage capacity than is needed to run the organization on a day-to-day basis. So by opening up the degrees of freedom, either through funds or other forms of response, there's an ability for an organization to get back on its feet quicker than if they were to try to use a slow methodology of moving a little bit at a time, which then stretches out the rate of recovery to a much longer period of time. The other dimension of this is that we're a smaller state, right? We've got less than 1 million people, and this type of line of work is highly specialized and very difficult. Back of the napkin, I think there's probably about 50 to 100 people in the state of Alaska who are qualified to do digital forensics and incident response. They're sprinkled throughout a variety of different organizations, and the ability for them to come together and respond is going to be difficult because a lot of them will be fighting their own fires. So being able to pull in outside resources, contractors from outside of Alaska, is an essential element. And I believe that this language opens up that degree of freedom as well, too, in addition to what Mr. Brunig indicated as well, too. In practice, when I was working with Mr. Wyatt and Mr. Brunig on the Mat-Su Borough, the expansion of capability from the emergency funds really did have a very positive impact. And we got to see a wave of momentum rise through the entire response team. And we bore the fruit of that. So that ends my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So now you have a whole bunch of people, questions for, and if you know who you'd like to ask the question, Representative Kirk, you were first, did you get all the questions answered? Do you have a follow-up and let us know who you'd like to answer the question?
I'll hold off for a second. I heard a lot of answers that may have answered my questions.
You want to reflect for a minute?
Yeah.
I'll put a question in for Mr. Andreessen. Mr. Andreessen, Representative Drummond asked a question about political subdivisions. Did you hear that question? Is that one you can answer for Representative Drummond? I think she's particularly interested in school districts.
Yes, Chair, for the record, this is Nils Andreessen. So the definition of political subdivision in law AS 26-23-900-7 is a municipality, an unincorporated village, or another unit of local government. It's our understanding that school districts would be covered under political subdivisions of the state. As the state's discharged its constitutional obligation for public education to those school districts. And for school districts, they come under two categories, either as units or as municipal school districts, so they actually subdivisions then of that municipality, or they're the responsibility of the Department of Education. So either way, school districts would be included in a definition of political subdivision, is our understanding. And then separately for the university, my understanding is that the university is considered a political subdivision, but separately under state law.
Representative Drummond, is that a satisfactory?
I'm looking at, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at section 39.90.140 definitions under Title 39, public officers and employees. And it says, a matter of public concern means, this is hard to read, E4, okay, a political subdivision of the state, including lowercase I, a municipality, II, a school district, and III, a regional educational attendance area. It says including those three items. What else does it include if it includes those three items? It does not appear to include the University of Alaska, and it also mentions that are not included a public or quasi-public corporation or authority established by state law, including the Alaska Railroad Corporation. And there are another bunch of those. And I guess, let's see, we're talking to Mr. Andreessen right now,
right.
And he mentioned Section 20,
Title
26, which I need to go look at.
Mr. Andreessen, do you want to repeat that code section for Representative Drummond?
Yes, for the record, Nils Andreessen, Alaska Municipal League. That's AS 26239007.
What was the last one? The last phrase? 7?
900 and then subsection 7.
Subsection 7. Okay, thank you. I would like to ask Mr. Brunig as well what his understanding is of political subdivisions.
Mr. Brunig, did you hear that question?
Yes, thank you, through the chair, Representative Drummond. That is unfortunately not something that I deal with or can speak to. I would have to defer on that particular question.
Other questions from the committee? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for Mr. Brunig as well.
Go ahead.
In our budget subcommittee, Mr. Brunig, you were speaking about a recent cyber security attack, and you spoke about a type of incident command that is being established under the Department of Administration for quick response. I forget the title of that exactly. If it would be helpful if you could speak to that type of structure for quick response. And I'm particularly interested on page 2, line 2, where it talks about the responsibility of the Commissioner of Administration or the Commissioner's designee certifies to the governor about the high probability of this attack. And is that particular wording of the Commissioner's designee still fit the more organized structure that you are establishing under the Department of Administration in specific response to cybersecurity still fit to be able to meet the requirements of the statute?
Through the chair, Representative Ant, thank you very much for that question. And yes, so the incident command structure, known as ICS, is a system put out through FEMA. It's the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and it's part of a national incident management program, and it is a standard framework that DMVA uses, that all federal agencies use. And so that structure, yes, is one that we use, and no, this would not change that. It would designate an incident commander, and again, DMVA, that's exactly how they do work. Anytime that there is not just a cyber incident, but any large-scale disaster, there's always an incident commander, and the framework is flexible. So, yes, it would address that very, very cleanly.
Representative, follow.
Would you mind describing for the committee the response that the most recent response that was implemented under our recent cybersecurity attack that you shared with us in our budget committee? I think it would be helpful in light of the language that we have here. Do you remember I apologize for putting you on the spot. I'm trying to remember what committee that you were talking about, but just that you are in the process of tightening up that structure right now. I think it would be helpful to have an update on that.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Vance. Yes, I am trying to remember which one. If memory serves, we had been working with Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to train and to build that structure and to get that capability for the state. We do have a incident response team, but it is not at a point at the state right now that we would be able to handle a large scale without involving DMVA and switching over to their structure. I'm trying to remember the specific example. Do you remember it all?
Representative Vance, you can answer the question from the witness.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My apologies, Mr. Bruning. I just remember that when you described that you were working on a swifter response within the administration to be able to kind of plug the holes in our cybersecurity, and that under the Department of Administration, you're getting more people appointed to be able to make those decisions in a quick manner. And the reason that I bring that up now is because this bill is speaking directly to that, because we're hoping that it highlights the importance that we kind of get our act in order in the state, because cybersecurity has become such a large topic, and it by the wording in the statute that it is the Department of Administration that will be the one that must initiate to the governor that there is a threat, and everything that we can do to make sure that that is a very quick response is going to help everyone in the long term.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, you may have sparked something in my memory. I think it was SolarWinds, and I was talking about speed. Speed is of the essence. And when that announcement came out from CISA about the SolarWinds vulnerability, we did not have, and we still don't have, that visibility, that very quick communication and framework laid out. So we had to, I had to send out a message, and it took about 24 hours for departments to report back if they had that vulnerable software. Two departments did, and we were then able to very quickly lock that down and go do forensics and found that there was no compromise. But in cyber terms, 24 hours is an eternity. That is way too slow. And so we are absolutely, and this is why this legislation is so critical, is it will bring the right people together to focus on building that speed to response. So I very much appreciate your question. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Representative Kirka.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, I have two questions. So I guess the first one is, do we have a definition or a clarity of a definition for imminent cybersecurity attack? Is there a metric or the probability, high probability? I mean, is there a metric to define that? Seems kind of a slightly nebulous. And my second question.
Go ahead and let's get the first question answered. One of the best smart techniques in this committee is if you have multiple questions, just ask one at a time, and then we'll come back to the next one. Who's best qualified to answer the question from Representative Kirka?
Mr. Chairman, Eric Cordero for the record. I believe Mr. Bruning is probably the best person to answer this question.
Mr. Bruning, go ahead and answer that question.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Kirka. So imminent threat would be something that we would get an alert either through CISA, which is the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, federal agency, or one of those partners, FBI, for example, to say there is a known attack, there is a known vulnerability that is being exploited, and it's coming at the states. We would then watch for that, and that would not constitute in and of itself a disaster, but it is a heightened threat level, and that would be imminent. We would not declare or seek to declare a disaster. The disaster would be, is unfortunately, if it got in and it did cause damage and we had to recover. But in terms of what an imminent threat, that would be one example. What was mentioned earlier about Microsoft, we get intelligence through a variety of sources, and we knew fairly early on that this was coming and were able to take proactive steps. That would be another example of a known vulnerability and the probability of an attacker utilizing that was quite high, so it raises that risk level, and we took steps. So that would be another example of an imminent threat.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I understand that, this is not my second question, but if I understand that correctly, through the chair, essentially the high probability stems from a vulnerability already being discovered by being attacked already, if I understand that correctly, in maybe a limited sense.
Mr. Bruning.
Through the chair, Representative Kirka, that's just one example. Like you said, there are many others. That's just one. There's unknown, there's known, or it can be even where there's not a vulnerability, but a state actor may choose to flood a network segment with malicious traffic in an attempt to overwhelm it and take it down. It's called a denial of service attack. There's not necessarily a vulnerability, but it is another attack type. So things, again, like that we watch for, and those are absolutely threats that they're always monitoring for.
Follow-up? Thank you.
No, that's good, but I have my second question now.
That counts as the follow-up.
Keep okay. Going. So my follow-up, but this might be to Representative Johnson, actually, through the chair, or Mr. Cordero. So in looking at this language, it looks pretty good that you're asking to add here to the security or to the disaster declaration statute. I just want clarity that we're confining this because, I mean, it sounds like cybersecurity attacks are happening all the time in varying degrees. What would constitute this being, I guess, an emergency is if it falls under, I guess, Section 1 of the bill, the beginning, line 4 on page 1, the number 2 there, disaster means the occurrence or imminent threat of a widespread or severe damage, injury, loss of life or property or shortage of food, water, or fuel resulting from, and then we get the list that we're adding to. So we're talking about widespread damage of property, if I understand correctly, and not just, say, one department had some computers fried or something, if I understand that correctly.
Right. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I recognize and appreciate that question. I recognize some concern has been brought up that, there's imminent threats all the time. So what does this keep you from having this, like, forever ongoing disaster emergency declaration, which I think is what I hear to be the question. And we've actually discussed that at length, and I'm going to let my staff answer
that. Mr. Cordero.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Kirka. And you are correct. The disaster would be determined by what is on Section 1, Page 1, Line 4, starting that area. And so imminent is really a matter of timing, and widespread is a matter of geography and whether or not an issue can be contained. So if we talk about, not cybersecurity, but say an earthquake or a flood or a fire, something like that, it depends on whether or not it can be contained and the amount of resources that would need to be used to be able to achieve the containment goal. And so all those things have to be taken into account. And the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs, they will work, they will create emergency plans for each one of these different categories that are listed in the Act, and they will probably make recommendations as to what it would be considered widespread and what is considered imminent. Because, like as you said, if it's just one department, and that department does not affect, does not have anything to do with loss of life or property or shortage of food or water, I mean, it's not really an emergency. So, like, for example, if it's a DMV and you just can't get a driver's license, I don't believe that that would qualify for an emergency. But if it's the Department of Health and Social Services and it's about benefits that deal with food stamps, for example, I believe that that would, that could potentially be considered. I hope that answered your question.
On their 16th birthday, thinking they have to get the driver's license that day could be a state emergency. Representative Kirka?
Yeah, quick follow-up. So, neighborhood or forest fire versus one house burning down, or you know, the entire state, the whole Mattsu or the whole Anchorage area, the power going out from a cyber attack where we can't get it up in one day, because this is Alaska, we have power outs on a regular basis. So if that's, if I'm understanding correctly. Okay, and then I had a slightly separate question.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, it seems like this language should be added. They're asking to add, but it also seems like a lot of the context in which we're talking about this is under D, enemy or terrorist attack or credible threat of imminent, or, you know, enemy or terrorist attack, because it seems like this is just another form of terrorist attack or a enemy attack in the case of China. Well, let's not say they're our enemy, but they're attacking us. If they're attacking us, if somebody's attacking us, then it would seem like it could this fall under D? And I guess you had, looks like you had a legal opinion you received on why this wouldn't apply under D, because most of these circumstances, all these examples we're talking about, are seem to be foreign actors.
Who was that a question for?
To the chair, I guess, Representative Johnson.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, might I ask for... To the chair, might I ask you to repeat that so I understand exactly what you're saying there?
I'll try to paraphrase, and if I get it wrong, Representative Kirker can correct me.
I apologize.
That's all right. I think he's generally asking that it seems like some of the threats are more under subparagraph D, but those don't seem like they're cybersecurity. How do you deal with kind of the two separate paragraphs and in determining whether an emergency has occurred? Did I get that mostly right?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Not too many. Let her answer the question, and then we'll keep going. If he doesn't like the answer, he can follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm gonna have my staff answer that question.
Or Mr. Cordero.
Through the chair, Representative Kirka, I apologize if I'm not able to answer your question, but this was a recommendation by our Ledge Legal to have it separate so that there would be no more confusion, given that right now the memo indicates that whether or not the governor can declare an emergency based on a cybersecurity attack, by having it separate, then there would be no confusion whatsoever.
Thank you.
And Representative Vance, you wanted to make a point of clarification. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill is specifically speaking to disaster, and the word emergency is nowhere mentioned in this bill. And I'd like to make that clarification because we've been under emergency for a year now, and that has since expired. But there is a distinction in statute between disaster and emergency, and this is just talking to disaster. For example, the mudslides in Haines, for instance, was the governor did declare a disaster in that area, but it wasn't a state of emergency for the entire state. So I would just like us to keep that in mind as we're speaking to the issue in this bill, because we often get those words interchanged, but I think it's important for the record. Thank you.
And Representative Eastman, I see you there with many blue books. You've been studying carefully, so I know you've got a question, at least one. Go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Yeah, so I'll go back to an earlier question. That was a cyber security. I'm just curious, since I don't use that word every day, and I'm sure not everyone does, when we're writing this word in, what are we using as our definition, and you know, what are the courts going to be able to use to understand what we mean by cyber security?
Mr. Cordero looks like the winner.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I do not have an exact answer for you. I don't know if Mr. Bruning would have one, but otherwise we'll have to get back to you. But
I'll let Mr. Bruning, I'll add in that it's a kind of a general proposition when a term is not defined in statute, but it's a commonly used term in which they can find definitions in the dictionary or other resources that are in the public. It is common for the courts to look to those sources for definitions that aren't defined by the legislature. But Mr. Brunig, do you want to add to that? Or I guess Mr. Brunig's probably the next. Yeah, Mr. Brunig, anything to say with regard to Representative Eastman's question?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the most simple basic definition I can give, and this is based on industry, is that cybersecurity is really any protection used to prevent cyber attacks. That's usually, a combination of technology, processes, people. Simplest terms, any of those used to protect against cyber attacks, that's what cybersecurity is.
Representative Eastman.
And follow up, whether for Mr. Bruning or someone else. I'm familiar with that definition. It makes sense to me. But in this case, we're talking about a cybersecurity attack. And so if we're using tools to prevent attacks, but then we're adding the word attack on, I'm a little confused at what that means.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I mean, the intent is it would be an attack against our cybersecurity. So against the systems and the tools that we have to protect ourselves, they would be attacking us, seeking to overcome that.
And follow up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So a run-of-the-mill cyber attack then isn't necessarily what we're talking about, as opposed to a more sophisticated, someone's trying to, overcome some kind of security type of attack?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, yes. I would agree.
Thank you.
Any further follow-up? No? Okay. Any other questions from any? Oh, Representative Eastman.
Thank you.
I thought you were
and,
done.
And I understand, going back to Representative Kirk's question, so in D, there's an enemy or terrorist attack, and then it specifically, calls out the meaning of attack there in Title 26. It occurs to me we don't have a similar calling out of the definition of attack in paragraph F, and the definition referred to in D doesn't, that definition of attack doesn't seem to quite fit what we're talking about in the cyber realm. So I'm wondering if it's appropriate to make it clear what it is we're talking about when we talk about an attack.
Mr. Brunig, you want to take a shot at that?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I definitely agree with Representative Johnson and Eric Cordero that the intent is to clarify, and that in D, enemy and terrorist attack traditionally is more military or more what we not cyber, whereas with F it is specifically delineating and defining cyber that allows the Emergency Operations Center to bring those resources to bear in regard to a cyber, not just the other traditional forms of disaster emergency attack that are already identified.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Bruning, I suppose, and looking at subparagraph F, which is the new language, you would distinguish a cyber attack, which might be, for example, somebody hacked into my computer and did whatever they could if they got into my home computer, versus a cybersecurity attack, which is a much larger scale and affects more of the things that are tried that are we believe protected on a larger scale basis.
To the chair, yes. Yep. That would be accurate.
Other questions? Representative Eastman.
Yes, so I want to reference for a moment the memorandum that we received from the Legislative Legal Services Division, and that talks about why paragraph C, equipment failure, may not be adequate, and why this bill might be needed for that reason. And I'm curious, to what extent is it the sponsor's intent to predicate the cybersecurity attacks we're talking about on intentionality. Because certainly if we're focusing on intentionality, then you know, an IT tech who spills coffee and destroys a server wouldn't probably be captured in the kind of attack that we're talking about here. And is that the intention, to distinguish between the impact, which I suppose could be the same if it's, you know, a large enough or important enough system, the outages could affect the same number of people, et cetera, but it wouldn't necessarily qualify as a disaster, even though, you know, people are without internet or whatever the impact might be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair to Representative Eastman, and I will allow for my staff to elaborate on this, but the intentionality must be have some credible background to that. And so what it would be is if it is imminent and widespread, as determined by the commissioner or the designee, and is focused in for that reason, he would determine that it was a threat, a credible threat. It's the intentionality of maybe mind reading someone would not fall into that category.
For the record, Eric Cordero, through the chair, Representative Eastman, I'm not sure I understand your question 100%, but the intention is the intention here is just to clarify that cybersecurity counts, and whether or not that means it's an attack or a threat or a vulnerability, those are more of technical questions. I'm like I said, I'm not entirely sure I understood your questions, and I don't know if you could rephrase it, perhaps.
Sure. Follow up.
Reverend, go ahead and follow up. I just know we're coming up on 3 o'clock, so this may be the last question for the day. We will certainly bring this bill back, but go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Yes, and to clarify, so in paragraph A and B and C, E, with the exception maybe of D, a terrorist attack, we're dealing with things that are not obviously man-made, and there's no intentionality behind them in terms of any, you know, human motivation. It's a rock slide, for example. There's no motivation behind that. And I'm just curious, is it important, as we're doing here in paragraph F, is it important to tie it to that intentionality, or should we be more focused on the impact and tying the, you know, ability to declare a disaster based on the impact, the, you know, imminent, widespread we were talking about earlier, but we've got this intentionality sort of here with the cybersecurity attack and so forth, and just wanted to know is there a reason that we're making it narrower than just, you know, a larger impact type of definition?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, and I believe the reason why is because in the legal memo has some background in this. The legislature removed the wordings man-made from the Disaster Act, and that's actually what caused a little bit of ambiguity to when we asked the question about whether cybersecurity or not qualifies under the Act. If a widespread system failure is the result of another cause that is not man-made, in this case, an attack or a threat, it actually would probably fall into one of the other categories. So in the case, for example, of an earthquake, a system goes down, but it's really the result of an earthquake, not necessarily a cybersecurity attack. And so if I'm understanding correctly, this would actually create clarity specifically to those type of items. I don't know if
Final
that
follow-up?
Makes sense.
Last one, Representative Eastman, we were running a little late.
Appreciate the indulgence, Mr. Chairman. So I guess is it important to make a distinction between those man-made actions which are intentional and which are accidental? So if you have, you know, there's an installation of a security patch which has the effect of causing a major outage, it wouldn't, you know, qualify here because it's not a cybersecurity attack, even though it could, you know, have the same effect as though it was one if it was somebody trying to do it intentionally.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, while that might not be an attack, it's certainly a potential vulnerability, and that's addressed in the language of Section F in another section, in another area. So a cyber vulnerability. So it's not necessarily an attack. I mean, there are so many definitions that we could include in this bill that would probably make it very, very lengthy. So like cyber attacks, cyber incidents, cyber threats, major threats, minor threats, primary targets. I mean, there are just so many technical words that we could be defining. And so we're just trying to make it clear that cybersecurity counts, give it an overview, and then it's up to the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs to come up with plans, with disaster plans and mitigation plans and all of that.
Thank you very much.
Well, suffice it to say, a lot of these things come back to questions of cost and the size of what's happened. The coffee on the processor probably is not unlikely to cause the same thing as the mudslide if the computer database is at the bottom of the mudslide. So we are going to conclude for today. We will still have public testimony on this bill, and hold on, I'm just taking a quick look here. We're going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Monday, March 15 at 1:30 p.m. with respect to House Bill 3. If you would like to offer amendments on House Bill 3, we're going to make those due on Wednesday at noon.
Say that again.
Any amendments on House Bill 3 will be due Wednesday at noon, submitted electronically to my office. And that would probably mean we'll take up amendments to House Bill 3 at the earliest on Friday. But I anticipate we will try to get back and finish House Bill 3 on Monday, but kind of stay tuned. It is, after all, Wednesday, and we haven't got the schedule set for next week, and we had another bill for today, which we didn't get to. So we'll see how all that rolls out, but I will get meeting notices out, and if it looks like we're going to be taking up anything and moving any bill on Monday, which I don't think we are, I'll let you know, because I know some of you like to attend virtually, and unless we're actually going to be moving a bill, attending virtually is fine from my perspective. And with that, we're going to adjourn for the day. It is 1:04 p.m.